Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and sorry for the late start. I was having a little trouble getting my telephone to work right. So we are now on the, I guess this is the 31st of January, and this is the Q&A call for the subscription side. So here's our first question for the day. How do you set up your boundaries with your spouse at the same time letting God work on him with his recovery and stay out of that? I am so confused. We've discussed this today, and we think we have some right ideas, but some practical solutions would help. So what does that look like? Thanks for your encouragement. I think that to begin, setting up boundaries for your spouse, in reality, it's not your boundaries for him or her. It's really the boundaries they begin to feel that they need in life. Now, you can set your own personal boundaries for what you can and can't tolerate and things like that. But if the boundaries are set to control or manipulate your mate, to me, we're kind of doomed or destined for failure. I mean, in the long run, your mate needs to begin to take responsibility for what they think needs to be happening in their recovery. Now, they may be open to feedback. They may not, you know, you may be able to give suggestions and say, I don't know what you're thinking about this, but at the same time, you need to be able to say what you need in order to feel safe and what you can and you can't tolerate. But if you're sitting there trying to set your boundaries to control their behavior, you get into a problem in the long run only because you don't want to have to be the one responsible for his or her recovery. And I know that may make it a bit more confusing, but I know that when I went into recovery, Steph and I certainly set some boundaries for the two of us that I thought were important for my recovery, but also just important for us to not be assuming that monogamy ultimately is going to happen. So how we interacted with people, going out to lunch, things like that, we absolutely eliminated from our agenda, so to speak. We didn't want to put ourselves in harm's way. So those were boundaries we set to protect the marriage. I certainly set some very strong boundaries for myself that I thought were important. The people that were involved in my recovery with me, the other addicts and other people dealing with infidelity that God was fortunate enough to bring into my life, they had some great suggestions. Because I was really blind, I think, to some of the difficult places for me. So those types of boundaries, I think, are terribly important. On the other hand, the boundaries that maybe where... I don't know exactly what you mean by boundaries, but hopefully that will it's really you need to set your boundaries for your recovery, what you need to be able to feel safe in the relationship. Hopefully the two of you can agree. He or she needs to be making all kinds of decisions on what's important to them and taking this thing very seriously. So, and then the two of you, what are the boundaries you're going to do to keep the relationship safe? With all of that, I think you'll do very, very well. And the other thing you might look at in the long run, if he can, I know that the Hope for Life course for the recovering person who's had the affair talks a lot about boundaries and appropriate boundaries to set in terms of recovery. So that might be something that would be useful for he or she in the future also. But I appreciate the question very much. That is a good one and a much-needed one. I think the whole boundary issue is very confusing for everyone. So I hope that gives you a little bit more direction and can offer some encouragement. Glad the two of you can even talk about that. To be honest, that is a much-needed step for many couples. So for question number two. Could you please explain the concept of suds? Can you also explain why relapse doesn't happen suddenly, but rather it's progression? Oh, I love that question. So in terms of suds stands for seemingly unimportant decisions. And In recovery, one way of looking at how we relapse, one aspect of it is what we call the use of wisdom. It's avoiding situations where you would ultimately get into trouble. It's accepting that maybe you're too weak, not maybe, that you are too weak to handle it. One of the things we teach at Affair Recovery is nobody ever relapses because they're weak. They only relapse because they're strong and they put themselves in circumstances that they think ultimately they can handle. So seemingly an important decision is a decision you make that places you in a it's not necessarily a bad situation per se, but it's a situation that's high risk for you because it's something that's led to acting out behaviors before in the past, and rather than assuming you're normal and you can handle those situations, you begin to assume you're not. And I tell the story of the guy who was here in Austin picking up prostitutes over on South Congress, and when he came in asking for help, I just asked him where he was always picking up his prostitutes. He told me South Congress, and I just made the simple suggestion, how about we not go to South Congress? And he thought that was, you know, a decent idea. He could do that and actually quit acting out, but didn't continue in recovery because he felt like he didn't have a problem anymore since he hadn't picked a prostitute up for several months. But then when he called about 6 months later, he started the conversation with, Rick, you won't believe this, but I picked up a prostitute. And I said, well, I believe it. I said, where'd you pick her up? And he said, well, on South Congress. And I said, well, I thought we weren't going to South Congress. And he said, but I didn't go to South Congress. And I said, well, then how'd you get there? Was it like, beam me up, Scotty? Were you teleported? I mean, what happened? And he said, well, I was going to a meeting at 11th in Congress, and I was going down 6th Street. And when I came to 6th in Congress, I looked at my watch, and I was 30 minutes early. So instead of turning north, you know, to go up to my meeting, I thought I need to kill some time, so I took a left and went southbound on Congress and, of course, went to the high-risk situation. And if you look at it, in his mind, he wasn't going to South Congress. Literally, he was trying to kill time. Well, typically the way people get into trouble again is they're kind of unaware that they're putting themselves in harm's way. I call it what they're like somebody walking around on a construction site without a hard hat, hoping somehow to get hit by the debris. They may not even be realizing or thinking consciously that they've done that, but for the recovering person or the person that's dealing with infidelity, you want to totally avoid those sites where something happened. And to the best of your knowledge, or if you're going to be in that situation, you want to be keenly aware, not unaware, so that you've got a plan in place in order to keep yourself safe. And so if you understand the concept of SUDS and you begin to think about and identify what are my high-risk situations, it really helps facilitate just a new way of living, a new lifestyle. And when I say, you know, it's why it's relapse doesn't just happen suddenly, but rather it's progression, I really think there's almost a – once we start putting ourselves in the high-risk situation, typically what people will do is it triggers reminders for them, especially if they're not really cognizant or conscious of what they're doing. And those reminders of what they once did, they'll begin to think about it. They fantasize about it. They may actually begin doing what we call grooming behaviors. They'll pick up behaviors of – maybe talking to people in a different way, or actually driving their car, looking. They begin to maybe scan more with their eyes, or they begin to allow themselves permission to surf the web, or they may to connect with old people that normally they didn't connect with, or whatever their behaviors are. They're not actually doing anything horrible yet, but what they've done is they've allowed themselves to do all the doorway behaviors that ultimately lead that direction. And so I say you always have to walk up to the edge of the cliff before you fall off. And if people are really honest with themselves, there's a whole series of seemingly unimportant decisions that kept putting them in higher and higher risk situations until eventually something happens. And, you know, I see most people beginning to lapse, what I call lapse behaviors, the ritual behaviors, the kind of old behaviors, but they've got this thing, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this, but they give themselves permission to begin doing some of the minor, along the fringe aspects of it, and that's what eventually gets them into trouble. Hopefully that'll be answer that one for you. Now for the next question, journal. Since before discovering my wife's affairs, I've kept a journal. it's a way to release a lot of emotion. And I was recently thinking of letting my wife read my journal so that she can get a better view into my feelings and how I deal with emotions. Do you think that this is a good idea? Some of my entries are very abrasive toward hers. I'd like us to be more intimate and figured I would lead by bearing all to her. I actually think that would be a horrible idea. Our journals really have nothing to do with truth. Our journals actually have a lot to do with the emotions and the feelings we go through while getting to the truth. But I find that generally people are very wounded when they read another person's journal. I would also say that if, you know, you're thinking about doing this, it would make me speculate that maybe you feel she doesn't really understand how this is impacting you, and she's kind of slow in kind of coming to an understanding of where you're coming from. And I think there may be some much better ways of doing that other than letting her read a journal. Something like 911 Marriage, which does a great job of empathy development. Something also like the Hope for Life course, which is being developed, and there'll actually be another version coming up pretty soon. That something like that would also be very helpful, because a great deal of time is spent trying to understand, help them understand what it's done to their mate. But I think if you share a journal, the problem is people begin to think that everything that's written is truth, and it's not. I mean, it may be true about the feelings you were feeling at that moment, but our feelings in journaling, they are ultimately just it's our process of ferreting through all of those emotions and getting down to the truth. Now, at the same time, you may be trying to communicate to her how badly you were hurt. And rather than letting her read the journal, another thing I would suggest is just sitting down with her and just saying, please let me try to explain once again what this did to me, if you don't mind. And she may be able to hear that, but you would do far better, or she would be far better served, I think, either doing a group course, getting part of one of our marriage life teams through 911 Marriage, or getting in one of the recovery teams. So I hope that helps with that, but again, would not advise doing the journal. Next question. I'm the hurt spouse. I'm wondering if waiting or having expectation, if I have expectations that I should not have. Or actually, I think it means I'm wondering if I am wanting or have expectations I should not have. You talk about the betrayer taking responsibility. What should this look like? We have a confession. My concerns lie with the why or the need that was being met with the affair partner. Also looking at the behavior. Is it addictive? I've been asking a lot of questions, and my spouse has a hard time putting a feeling or emotion with an action. I've stepped back these past few weeks, and nothing. No talking about the past. If the behavior is addictive, what should responsibility look like? Am I expecting too much? Okay. Don't quite have enough information here. I will tell you that the why will take a very long time for someone to figure out. I mean, there's some whys that are relatively easy to figure out, but typically the why that you're asking is it's about your need to try to understand what is this, and I think that's reasonable simply because you want to know whether you're safe or you're not safe, whether there's hope or there's not hope, are we doing what needs to be done in order to move our marriage forward. If you know, you're 2 years out or 5 years out, I would hope that maybe that other person, your mate, has done enough work in order to know some of the whys. When you start looking at what needs were being met by the affair partner, my concern about that particular point is is if you're trying to compare yourself against the affair partner. I really don't think it has anything to do with the affair partner. I think it has something to do probably with an aspect of your mate and a broken piece in them, and a way the affair partner was simply a way they were trying to get an itch scratched. So be careful about trying to, I think, compare yourself, even if that leads to maybe on the, if you found the what that person was doing, can you meet the same need? And I would say, well, that would be my concern that you're saying that, and I wouldn't want you to go there at all. I think he needs to look at that. Knowing whether or not the behavior is addictive by nature, I think, is important, and there's some really good online tests that talk about sexual addiction. I think a therapist ought to be able to talk with you about that, and it would be a place that it would be a very good, it'd be money well spent trying to determine that, because if they are an addict, then the course of treatment really is dictated by that and what they ultimately need to heal. If the why is because they've got a drinking problem, then that needs to be addressed. If the why is because, I mean, the why is a difficult one to get to, but I think you may need some help, it sounds like, and your mate may need some help. I would certainly, again, think that being in a group, again, like 911 Marriage, the aftercare groups from EMS, anything like that is going to be terribly important, because if you're not talking about this week by week by week by week, then it makes healing much more difficult. I mean, one of the biggest, most significant factors in whether or not couples heal and whether or not you as the betrayed spouse heals really is determined by your ability to process and talk and ultimately get your questions answered. So, I think that being in kind of a disciplined situation such as an ongoing group where you've got to address those things really improves the ability to survive all of this and actually have what you want in the long run. So if you're not in a group of some sort, I would recommend that you do that, because I think it would be very, very, very helpful for you. And it doesn't surprise me, last but not least, that if you're not bringing it up, that they're not bringing it up, simply because they're going to want to avoid the pain. Not saying that that's an okay thing to do, but they need to be in their own recovery. That's, their own course of recovery and their own talking to other people trying to explore this thing. And if they're not, then it's like we all want to go back to pretend normal, like there's not a problem. And I don't think that there's any wisdom in doing that. So please keep asking questions, but I would also get involved in kind of ongoing support, which I think in the long run will serve you very well in your recovery. Next question. Type of affairs. I've read the types of affairs on your website many times, and I feel that my husband's affair doesn't really match any one of those, but seems to have a combination of several. Is that possible? And absolutely, that is possible. I can answer that right now. I know that I actually kind of covered two different parts of the spectrum, which, I mean, there's reasons it happened that way. If so, does that make it harder for him to get it and understand totally what he has done to me in the marriage? He still doesn't seem really remorseful, just sorry and maybe guilty to some extent. I think that I don't know that it's necessarily the type of affair. I mean, that certainly, if someone is miserable in a marriage and they weren't happy in the marriage to begin with, I think they may feel guilty about what they've done. Now, I'm making a total assumption. I don't know in your situation, but a lot of times it takes a while for remorse to come in, because if they're continuing to carry resentments toward their mate, if he's still carrying resentments towards you, he'll tend to be blaming rather than, I think, honestly being able to look at himself. One of our mentor couples have a very interesting story. I think it was about 6 years after discovery and reconciliation before he actually moved to the stage of sincere remorse for his mate. And part of that was because he was so angry at her. Now, they had a good marriage during that time period, and he knew that maybe something was amiss, as did she, but he honestly could not get in touch with those feelings until he had been able to really forgive her for all of the things he had held against her and was able to honestly look at himself and his own baggage. And I think with resentments, we don't understand this. And again, I'm making the assumption that maybe what's causing this is resentments. But resentments are incredibly dangerous when it comes to a marriage. Because if I hold those resentments, it's a way, or it prevents me ultimately from looking at myself and causes me to keep a focus aimed at some other place, wherever that resentment is. And I'll never heal as long as I carry those resentments. So if that's the case, it would seem to me, if I'm right about that, I would certainly hope he would get help for those resentments and try to figure out how to forgive you. And I think you'll find that the remorse comes in the long run. Just talking is going to be one of those things that's really important to people. So keep talking. Last but not least, question for the day. What is acting real after an affair? Both my husband, the unfaithful one, and I have noticed that we really tiptoe around each other. Each of us is trying hard not to upset the other one. This doesn't feel like marriage to me. It seems very awkward and stilted. I wouldn't ever say or do anything to deliberately hurt him or make him mad, but the way we are both acting now is not the way I want to be with my husband. I want to feel that whatever I say or do, if it's not intentional, then he should love me and care for me and the same for me with what he does or says. I just don't feel I can relax and be real. Is this normal after an affair? Will it ever get better, or is this the way we will always be if we stay together? So one of the problems, and this is more of a marriage issue and not an issue with an affair. I mean, the affair may be uncovering a bigger issue is all I'm suggesting. Intimacy in marriage, which kind of means into me see, it's about a willingness to be known and a willingness to know. Intimacy in marriage, once you get past the first kind of few years of a marriage, actually is creates short-term instability. It's not something that ultimately makes us close because there are differences. Most couples believe that intimacy or the goal of the marriage is closeness. It's not. The goal of the marriage is to be known and to be able to love another person okay as is, good enough just the way they are, not because they are exactly how we want them to be, but in spite of how they are. One of the things Jesus says I think that's really cool is he said, you know, if you love someone who's everything you want and never has any conflict, you have any differences with, or they make you feel good about you, he goes, woohoo, anybody would do that. But to love someone who's a disappointment or difficult, he said, now that would be my love. And I think as we begin to go through recovery, we want to almost avoid intimacy, and it's called intimacy avoidance. We do tiptoe around because we, you know, things are so scary. You know, we don't want to kind of touch that thing and trigger all the emotions and the shame and everything. But strong marriages, it's not that they don't have conflict. 2/3 of all marriage issues are unsolvable. Strong marriages are able to stay connected in the face of that conflict, and that is a learned skill. It's about learning how to continue to talk and to be honest, I mean, and very careful in a sense that, you know, in how we present things, not with the intent of trying to hurt or damage, not an aggressive expression, but it's being able to be known. You guys are different. But the only way you begin to move into what's called the out of the conflict stage into the growth stage into the union stage, a lot of times it's about first off, your own individual work and growing and learning how to love, but also learning how to accept differences and getting out of my own self-centeredness and being willing to consider another person's subjective reality. But if the goal that the two of you are working toward right now is sameness, if it's trying to see things the same way all the time, or you feel like you've got to be on the same page, or I think that, you know, you won't grow. You'll stay stuck. But if you can learn and have someone to help facilitate your ability to, I guess, be honest with each other, then in the long run, you'll have a very, I think, productive relationship, and you'll come to the place where you both can accept and love each other. Okay, is this good enough just the way you are? And you'll also feel that it's not that your love necessarily, I guess it's not a love because you've earned it. It's a love because there's still a great deal of respect, even though there's a difference, and you don't see things the same way. And that's what I want people to be able to get to as they go through this marriage. It's not about learning to be the same. It's about learning to love. And hopefully you will continue to strive to do better, that you can both catch that vision. I hope your mate will do that with you. And that you can be real and still relax and hang on to yourself and be peaceful. So that concludes all of our questions for today. I want to thank everybody that joined the call, and I hope you have a good end of January, and we'll talk to you next week, first week of February. Oops.